To our quiz one review. I'm Rose, and I'll be doing the first part of today's review. And here's what I'm going to cover: hash tables, binary search trees, tries, and Huffman coding. So hash tables, well, before we can talk about hash tables, we should probably talk about data structures in general. So the first data structures you guys learned about were arrays, where it was very easy to index. You just go array, your array name, bracket, and the index inside. But with arrays, you have to declare a size beforehand, so its size is static. It's not very helpful if you have a dynamic set of data and you want to keep on adding things or changing things. And then you guys learned about linked lists, which were really easy to insert and delete, but they had a slow lookup time. You had to iterate over each of the nodes to see if what you wanted was in there. So sort of the solution to this, or the optimization, would be hash tables, where you can... Like, the most common hash table you can think of is probably a combination between an array and linked list, which I'll show you in a bit. But they're more or less easy for looking up and inserting and deleting. But if you're trying to sort with them, it might not be such a good idea. So to have a hash table, you need, well, a hash table, which is actually just an array. And you also need a hash function, which is more or less a math algorithm to place each element. So it takes something intrinsic to the element, say, I don't know, the ASCII value of the first letter, and then it gets you an index from that, from the, from your element. And then you should also modulo your table size to stay in range, and possibly also absolute value in case you get a negative number and you try to index a negative slot in your array, which I think some people did in your speller in the beginning. So there are sort of two types of hash tables. The first is linear probing, and this is the less common one, I think. It's not my favorite. But basically, you have your big array, and you store data in each of those slots, as opposed to, say, pointers or a linked list. And then if there's a collision, you go on to the next slot in your array. And then the sort of the con of that is you need a gigantic array to hold, you know, one slot for each piece of your data, unless you want to, like, kick something out. So here's an animation of how this works. Up there, you'll find the words that we're trying to stick into our hash table. And there's our hash table. And let's say this is our hash function. And since I could only fit, like, 9 squares on the screen, hash size is 9. So what our index here is, I think you've seen it before, it's going to take the first letter of the word and then, you know, get the, like, subtract the ASCII A such that A maps onto 0, B maps onto 1, and so on. And we're going to mod it by the hash size so it fits in the table. So say our first word is Derek. He hashes to 3. So we stick him in there. Awesome. Our next word is Jesse. He hashes to 0. So we stick him in there. Everything is going fine right now. Next we have Matt, who, oh no, also hashes to 3. What do we do? We could totally kick out Derek and stick in Matt, but then Derek would be, like, gone forever, and that would be bad. So what you would do is you would just go on to the next slot. So we stick Matt in 4, even though he hashed to 3. Okay, all is well. What happens if we have Malin, who also happens to hash to 3? Oh no, we have a collision where Derek was. We don't want to kick him out. We established that before. So we go to the next place, and Matt's there. So, oh no, we have another collision. What do? Same thing. We just stick him in the next available slot. So that's pretty much the basic idea of linear probing. It, if you have a lot of collisions, it could degrade into pretty much linear searching, because as you see, when you want to check something, you would go to the index, and if it's not there, you would start linearly going through each of the slots below it. So this might not be a very good idea if, you know, you were going to implement hash tables, which I'm sure most of you did, and did not use this method. The second type of hash tables is separate chaining, which I think most of you are familiar with. It, in your gigantic hash table, you store pointers, as opposed to, like, the whole word itself or the data. And if there's a collision, you create a linked list, or you add on to your linked list that's already there. So you're going to need structs. And in your structs, you're going to need a data field and then you need a pointer field to point to the next node. So here's our example. Again, same layout. First we have Derek. He hashes to 3. So we just have our pointer at 3 point to our piece of data. Next we have Jesse, who hashes to 0. And it's all good. We have our pointer at 0 point to Jesse. Now we have Matt, who also hashes to 3. So, oh no, we have another collision. We could, you know, just have the pointer at 3 point to Matt and not point to Derek anymore, but we would lose Derek and that would be bad. So what do? We have Derek's pointer field point to Matt. Yay, all is good. So say we have Malin, who happens to also hash to 3 with our hash function here. So, oh no, we have a collision. What do? We just stick him onto the end of our linked list that's already there. So pretty sure you guys are familiar with this, having done Speller. Next up, I'm going to talk about binary search trees. The word binary means that it's a tree, so it's a data structure of nodes, and it's binary such that each node only has two slots for pointers, and the pointers may be null, but they can only have a max of 2 children. So as you can see here, each of these nodes either has 0, 1, or 2 children. They can't have 3, because it's binary. And then search, to make it easier to search for a number, say, you follow this convention where you have the larger number on the right, and you have the smaller number on the left. So here you have the smaller number on the left, and, well, we don't have anything here. Smaller number, 51 is smaller than 61. 171 is larger than 61, so it's on this side. And you can probably see how this lends itself to easier searching. Say you got a number, I don't know, 100, say. You look at your root, and you're like, oh, 100 is greater than 50, so I should go to the right. And then you check that, and you continue doing that until you either find a number or you hit a null pointer. Questions? And then, by convention, the topmost node, where everything sort of springs from, is called the root. And these nodes down here are called the leaves. You can think of this as sort of an upside-down tree. Or I guess I could have drawn it that way, but... And also, by convention, the child is what the parent is pointing to. So 50 is the parent of 61. 61 is the parent of these two.
I have a question.
Yeah?
Can you go back to that slide?
Yes, sure.
Is there a reason? Mm-hmm. Is 51 below 61 only because when you were adding to the tree, it was added later on?
Yes. Oh, the question is, why is 51 down here as opposed to, like, say, up there somewhere, right?
Yeah.
And the answer is because, yes, it was added later, because you build the tree starting from the root. So, yeah?
Did you have, like, 49 below 61? Is it still smaller than 61? Or does it have to be?
So the question was, could we have 49 below 61 on the left side or the right side?
On the left side.
Instead on the left side. Yes, you could have 49 here. It's just, say, wait, 61? Oh, right. Bigger than 50. Yes. Sorry, you can't have 49 here because you would have to start at the root and then all of this has to be bigger than 50. So 49 would have to go over here. Eek. Thanks. More questions? Alrighty, so let's move on to tries, which is my favorite data structure, because that's what I did for Speller. But apparently that was not the right choice. Anyway, so in terms of the big board, but for tries, you can think of it as an array plus a search tree, kind of. So I'll elaborate and show you an example in a little bit, but so a try is a data structure of nodes, like a tree. And the data is spread out on the paths from the root to the leaf. Like, you don't have one node that has, like, your word in there. Your word is spread out throughout, like, the path. I'll show you that in a little bit. But first, we have to talk about what our node is going to look like. So you're going to have So you're going to have this check field, and you're going to have a really big array of pointers to, say, your characters. So if you were doing Speller with a try, you would have 27, I think, of these slots, one for each of the letters, and then one for that apostrophe character. And the check would be for, I'll show you in a moment. It'll become clear with this example. Okay, so say we're implementing a try. Our words are gonna appear up there. And since it can't fit like 27 characters on screen, if you see those dashed lines for the array, that means that we're skipping some letters in between. So say our first word is Derek again. And to stick him into our try, we're gonna look at it character by character, like the word character by character. We're not gonna stick the whole word in and then like link it to a big array. So now we're looking at the D, and in our gigantic root up there, we find the D slot of the array, and we have a pointer point to another node. So that's just saying that we're gonna create a path starting with the D. And then we look at the next character, which is E, and then in the second node of our path, we're gonna find the E slot, and then we're gonna make a pointer, like we're gonna build our path using the characters of Derek. So you can sort of see how this works. You know, the next characters are, so we continue building our path, and our next letter is E, until we get to the end, where you don't really wanna build a path anymore because like you've got your word, so you change your check field to true. So if you wanted to, you could put the whole word Derek into the check field, but that would take more space than, say, a Boolean, which is true or false. So to emphasize, say next we have Jesse, whose name starts with J. So we're just gonna start building a path with J from our root node. And we look at each of the characters in Jesse's name, and we build our path till we get to the end, where we put, you know, true in that last part of the path. Yes?
So how does the, so say you're searching for Derek.
Yes.
And you get down to the array that has true in it.
Yes.
How does it know that it's a K as opposed to a J or an I or an H?
Well.
What's the question?
Oh, the question is once you get down to, whoops. Once, if you're checking, you get down to here. That's right. Well, I kind of ran out of room, but your question, the question was that once you get here, you should actually have another, like, for Derek, whose name ends in the K, you should have another pointer here pointing to, like, another node where the check value would be true, as opposed to, like, putting true up here. Because that way you actually do keep the last letter of, you know, of your word. So, oops. But, so you would pretty much do the same thing for each of your words. So here we have Matt, who should also have another node, which I have forgotten to do. And then the interesting thing happens when you have sort of a collision, but it's not a collision in the sense that you need to kick somebody out. So we have Malin, whose name starts with M, that we've already gotten a list for Matt. So all you do is you just follow that path. You don't need to create another node or anything. So M, A already has a path, so we followed that path down. And then here we have L, which is different, so we just make another, like, split off the path. And then we continue from there. And of course, this should have, like, another node down here, so we can get that N. Questions? Okay, so on to Huffman coding. Huffman coding is a form of data compression. It's based on the frequency of the appearance of a character. So say you had some sort of text file that had 99% A's and like one B in there. If you were to use a fixed length coding for each of the characters, you would have to assign each of the characters the same amount of bits, even though A appears more often, and you could probably use a different amount to represent the more frequent character. So Huffman coding assigns fewer bits as opposed to, say, fixed bit length like ASCII. ASCII assigns each character 8 bits. And the algorithm for Huffman coding is, first you calculate the frequency of your characters, or your characters, and then you order them from, well, you order them from most frequent to least frequent, and then you add the two smallest frequencies, and it says connect up there because I'm going to show you sort of like a tree where you connect the frequencies in a bit. And then for three, you repeat until you get all the way to 100% when all your frequencies have been added together. And then after that, you go through your tree, and wherever you see a fork, where the a fork is in, like wherever you added two frequencies, you assign a 1 and a 0 to the top and the bottom, but you have to be consistent. Like you, if you're going to assign a 1 to the top, you have to do it for all of the forks. Don't, no?
You don't have to be consistent.
Well, I mean, like you can assign a 0 to the top of the fork, but you should probably do it throughout. And then after that, you can read off the bits starting at the root, and that'll give you the bits needed to encode your character. So say we had that piece of data where I've calculated the frequencies for you, and they appear in that order. I've ordered them from most frequent to least frequent. So if you have the algorithm I just showed you, first we add the two smallest, which is 3 and 1, and then we continue doing that until we've added up all of our frequencies. And there's a reordering. So we go about doing this. Okay, so once we've got our 100% frequency, you go back and you like label the forks. So there we go. I've labeled each of the top ones zeros because I wanted to, and the bottom one's one. You could do it the other way around, but you might want to be consistent. So to read off the bits, you would read them off from here to there. And let's say we were reading off A. We would go 1, 0, and then follow the path back to A. So for A, we can represent that with two bits, 1 and 0. And then for B, we can follow that path back, 1, 1, all the way back to B, and B can be represented as 1, 1 with two bits. And then for C, we do the same. We find that we can represent that as 0, 0. And then for D, and then for E. So if you notice here, if you just use the ASCII, you would have had to use 8 bits for each of these characters, but here you can just use, you know, 2 bits or 3 bits, and that's, in my opinion, a big savings.
So essentially what you have is you count up all the letters in your file, and you build a chart of frequencies. So here we're saying there are 21 total letters in our file. A occurs 7 times, B 6, C 4, etc. That part is clear thus far, right? So what we're doing now is we're picking the two lowest frequencies, okay? So the two lowest here are D and E, 3 and 1. And we're combining these into a single like meta character that represents both D and E, now with frequency 4. And now we recursively repeat the same thing. So now we have 4 letters, A, B, C, and then this one meta character, D and E, right? So now we have the two lowest frequencies are 4 and 4. We combine those into 8. And then we keep going until we get to the root node of our tree. And then we go down, and whenever there's a fork in our tree, we pick one side and number it 0 and another side and number it 1. And that way, every single letter has a unique path through the tree. Some have shorter paths than others. So a question for you is, why did we start by picking the letters with the lowest frequencies? Why didn't we pick the letters with the highest frequencies? Yeah?
You want the longest numbers to be the ones with the least frequencies, so that the most frequent ones don't occupy that much space.
Right, exactly. So if we had started by picking the highest frequencies, then the letters that occurred the most would have the longest number of bits, right? And so the whole point is to get our data as compressed as possible. And so if we pick the shortest frequencies, the letters that occur the least will have the most bits, and the letters that occur the most will have the fewest bits. And so that works out well for us. Yes?
Why do you have to reorder them?
Oh, that was just to make the slide more clear. So the question was, why did we have to reorder these things here? That was just to make the slide more clear. You don't actually have to reorder. Yeah. You can just draw your tree however you wish. And you don't always have to number the top 0 and the bottom 1 or the top 1 and the bottom 0. As long as every fork has a numbered 0 and 1, then you'll be okay. You'll still have an unambiguous code. Question back there.
So I guess when you don't have a fork, like going from like on C, or I guess let's say like D or E, you go like 0, 1, 0, 1 something.
Yeah.
There's no fork after that first 0.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this slide was a little bit confusing. But if we do this here, A, B, C, D, E, so what do we have? 7, 6, 4, 3, and 1. So we pick the two lowest, D and E, all right? And so we put D down here and E over here, and these go up with a combined frequency of 4, all right? Now we have the next two lowest, so these are gone, 4 and 4. These go up with a combined frequency of 8. All right? And then the next lowest is not 8, but 7 and 6. So we combine these. So 7 plus 6 is 13. And then now we're rid of all of this, right? And so we have only two letters remaining. We combine them and we get 21, so our total letters. And so now it's much clearer. We just go and number 0, 1, you know, whatever. We want a number, and we have our code, right? So if we read the code, for example, somebody tell me what the code for C is. C is 10, right? And then the code for D is 110. So that's, yeah, so I guess it's nice with the animations and stuff, but that's maybe a clearer picture of the tree. So another quick question. Sometimes you compress something with Huffman coding, and it's actually bigger than the original file. Anyone want to take a guess as to why? Yeah?
There are more characters, like a lot of characters.
Why are there a lot of characters?
Like there, because that's, like, the more, like if they were all of it down to Z,
Okay, but each 1 and 0 is a bit. It's not actually an ASCII 1 or something. So it's actually smaller. But any other ideas? Yeah?
Maybe, like, would that happen if all the frequencies were about the same?
So if all the frequencies were about the same, you can still gain some savings if you don't use the full ASCII space. Right? ASCII is 8 bits, so we can represent 256 different characters. If we're only representing 2 characters, we only need 1 bit, right? 0 or 1. So that's not quite the reason. So think about decoding. If I have a file encoded with this code, how do I decode it? Yeah.
You need to be given the code.
Yeah, I need to know what this tree looks like. So whenever we compress something with Huffman, we also have to store some representation of the tree along with the file, right? So if the file's really large, then the tree is very, very small in comparison. But if the file's small, we store this tree, it's going to end up taking more space, and our compressed file is actually going to be bigger than the original file. Okay, so that's all. And one minor point about binary search trees. So suppose I have a binary search tree, just like the classical way that we've explained it to you. And I start off with the number 100, and then I start inserting numbers in my tree. And every single number I insert is larger than 100, and every single number that I insert is larger than any previous number I've inserted. So I'm inserting a continually increasing sequence of numbers. Does anyone see any problem that's going to occur? Yeah?
You have a linked list.
You have a linked list, right? Because, so we start off with 100, and then maybe we insert 102, and then if we insert 104, we just keep going to the right, right? So there's a key. Your trees always have to be balanced, and there's various algorithms that will balance your trees for you, which we don't go into here, but just know that if you don't balance your tree, this sort of thing can happen. So you're not actually gaining sort of a logarithmic search efficiency that you would get if your tree is properly balanced. So any other questions about any of that? All right. So from C to binary. So in this class, we've been writing code in C. And so what happens when you hit GCC, you know, myfile.c, and so on and go forth? So it's a multi-step process. So we compile our code, it gets translated to assembly code, and then from assembly code it gets translated into object code, and that's stuff that the computer can run. But the process is actually a little bit more involved than that. So first step is pre-processing. So anything that you write, pound define, pound include, or anything like that, this is something that gets sort of gotten rid of in the first step of compilation, which is pre-processing. And so you can think of pre-processing as find and replace in Microsoft Word or something like that. The pre-processor will go through, look at every single place that says pound include. And so if you say pound include dictionary.h, like in your spell checker problem set, what happens when the pre-processor sees pound include dictionary.h? Anybody? Somebody was going to yell it out. Yell it out. Yes. So when we say pound include dictionary.h, the preprocessor goes, opens the file dictionary.h, takes the text, and literally just drops it in there. And when we say pound define, so we pound define some constant or we pound define some macro, the preprocessor goes through the file, looks for all occurrences of that constant, and literally copies and pastes, substitute the text in. And so preprocessing is literally just text replacement. So once that has happened, then GCC works. And GCC takes your higher level C constructs, like your for loops, your if statements, your struct definitions and everything, and translates it into assembly code, which is about as close you can get to the machine that's still in human readable form. And if you like looking at code like this, you can take CS61. So assembling means that we now take this assembly code and we translate it into hex, into literally bytecode, like sequences of instructions for the processor. And this step is actually, you know, pretty simple because every single sort of primitive instruction is a single processor instruction. So it's just a matter of mapping the text to bytes that the processor can understand. And so finally, the last step. So at this point, we've produced all of these files that are .o. So if you ever do a ls after you compile, you'll see files in your directory, dictionary.o or 15.o or something like that. And so these are files with object code. And what we have to do now is if we have a program with multiple source files, we have to assemble those into a single file. So if we have functions that we've called from other places, if we've pound included any libraries that we're using things like printf or a2i or your favorite library function, we need to also get the object files for those libraries, which are stored somewhere else, but the compiler knows where they are. And we need to all sort of link these all together into a single file that your computer can then execute. And so that's sort of the compilation process in a nutshell. Any questions about that? Yeah.
So for the libraries, there will already exist an object code file that corresponds to what was referenced in what we wrote?
Yeah, so those are not .o, they're .a files, and they just exist on your machine, pre-compiled. Yes?
When it translates into object code, mm-hmm. It translates into hex or binary?
Well, everything is stored in binary. Right, so it just translates into binary sort of sequences of instructions that your processor could understand and execute. So what happens during linking is sort of you take these various object files that each have code for functions, and you have to combine them together. So you have to sort of do address resolution of the locations of functions, and various global variable names need to get resolved, and a couple of other things, and also link in your pre-compiled library files. All right, so bitwise operators, some other lower level stuff. So we've seen, a bunch of, The best way to think about bitwise operators are your Boolean operators and if statements. So you ever do if x is equal to 2 and y is equal to 3, then do this, or if statements like that? So bitwise operators allow you to do the same exact thing with bits. So the way to think about these is that a 1 in binary is true, and a 0 is false. And then you can sort of mash bits together, compose them with these operators, essentially like Boolean algebra, and then get resultant bits. So if we have AND, when is AND going to give us a true result? If we're ANDing two bits together, what values do we have in order to get A1, a true? 1 and 1, right? As somebody said. Yes? Because those are the only thing. True and true will give us true resultantly. OR is the same thing. Exclusive OR, somebody want to tell me what exclusive OR is? Exactly. So with OR in your if statements, if you have an if statement, if x is equal to 2 and y or y is equal to 2, if both x and y are equal to 2, your if statement will return true. With exclusive OR, if you OR 1 and 1, 1 and 1, exclusive OR together, will return you false. NOT will flip bits, meaning invert them. So if you take some byte and you NOT it, every 1 will turn to a 0, and every 0 will turn to a 1. Left shift means take all of these bits and move them left. And so sort of if we start moving bits left, some bits will fall off the end, right? And we'll have some space at the right. What comes in at the right? Zeros. All right. What about for right shift? It depends. So the answer is it depends. If we shift right, there's two different types of right shifts. There is a logical right shift, which means that we just start moving right. Everything that falls off of the right gets discarded, and everything that you bring in from the left is a zero. There's arithmetic shift, which means that if we're shifting a signed number, if you recall, we learned a little bit about 2's complement notation. And so all negative numbers have a 1 in the most significant bit position. So that's like the leftmost position. So if there's a 1 there, a signed shift will bring in 1's from the left. If there's a 0 there, it'll bring in 0's from the left. And so this is slightly architecture dependent and compiler dependent and a couple of other things, but just a point of caution for right shifts. So a couple of examples with bitwise operators. What are the values of x and y now? Anybody want to take a guess? So first of all, what are we doing? I kind of wrote this in a clever way, but what we're actually doing is we're executing 3 lines of code. So we've got x OR equals y OR equals x, and then x OR equals y again. So we're XORing 3 times. And we're storing back. So what's x? X starts with 5 and y starts with 6. After we do that, what are the values of x and y?
It looks like it's a swap.
It is a swap. It's exactly what it is. So if we wanted to work out an example, and I don't screw this up, which I sometimes do when I have to do math on the board, even if it's just adding ones and zeros. So suppose this is x and this is y. All right, so here are our 2 numbers. So if we XOR these together, what am I going to get resultantly?
One, zero, zero, one.
So I'm going to get 1, 0, 0, 1. So this is x OR equals y. So this means that this is the new value of x right now. So let's actually store that right here. 1, 0, 0, 1. And then here's y, 0, 0, 1, 0. Now we do this again. What do I get here? 1, 0, 1, 1. OK. So this is now the new value of y. So I'm going to just write that in here to save space. OK. So that's y OR equals x. And now I do it a final time. And hopefully it works for me. What do I get? 0, 0, 1, 0. And this is in x. So we've swapped these 2 values. All right, any questions about this? What about this? Okay, so let's work through it step by step. Starting with not zero. What is not zero? So we're taking the, so imagine that x is an int and n is some constant number, whatever, between 0 and 32. So we take not zero, it gives us an int worth of bits, all flipped to ones. So we have the highest possible unsigned binary number. Right? So we have all ones, and then we left shift by n. What does that give us? So let's draw this out over here. We have all ones, and now we've left shift by some constant number, suppose 7. Suppose n is 7. So we're getting 7 zeros in from the right, right? So now we have the binary number that's ones followed by zeros, and we've got 7 zeros here and 25 ones if we're on a 32-bit system, right? Now we take all of that and we not it. So we flip it. What am I getting? Right. So I'm getting 7 ones and all zeros. And now the final step is and that with our variable x. So let's think of what happens. I have this number here. You're what? Yeah, you're basically truncating x. So x has some bit values here. If you AND it with x, you know that wherever there's a 0 on top, there's going to be all zeros here, right? And then so because if you're doing bitwise AND, right? And wherever you've got 1s here, so the last 7 bits of x are going to be preserved, right? So it gets you the least significant 7 bits of x. That's what this does. So just a couple of puzzles with bitwise operators. Yeah?
Is there a systematic way where the left and right sides of a number represented in binary is the big end of the
scale? Coming up on the next slide or two. Other questions? Yes?
What if you have zeros in those last bits of x?
Mm-hmm.
When they get turned into ones?
They won't, right? So if you imagine that x, wherever there's a 1 in x, 1 and 1 will produce a 1. Whenever there's a 0 in x, you're doing bitwise AND, so that will give you a false. That will give you a 0. All right, so actually, so before we get to that, so another practical use of bitwise operators. So who did the Sudoku problem set? Awesome. So remember that one of the challenges on the Sudoku problem set was not allowing the user to change pieces that started in the initial configuration of the board. Everybody remembers this, right? So did anybody find a solution for that that had to do with bitwise operators? Okay, so we'll talk about a solution. So everybody just made simply a copy of the board, and then so in your copied board, you could store which numbers were original, right? So it turns out that your board is represented as an array of ints, right? And so ints, you have 32 bits. But the pieces of your board were only numbers from 0 to 9, right? So how many bits do you need to represent numbers from 0 to 9? Like 3 bits or something? So you have like 29 extra bits that are completely unused, that are just useless bits sitting there. So based on that, what could you do with bitwise operators to prevent yourself from making a whole nother copy of the board just to store which pieces came with the board? So basically, I'll just say the answer. I don't have any slide to do with this, but you could pick one of these bits that you know was never going to be used because you're always storing numbers from 0 to 9 and say, okay, if a piece came with the board, we'll set that bit to 1. And if it didn't come with the board, that bit will be 0. And then whenever the person makes a move, you construct a bitwise mask, something like this. You isolate that one bit, and you test it to see if it's 1 or 0. And then you know, was this an original piece or an unoriginal piece on the board? All right. So, endianness. So this is a rather arcane hardware-dependent thing. But it turns out that different processor architectures, some are little endian and some are big endian. which means that if you have a number, like an integer, which is 4 bytes, the order in which this integer is stored in memory can vary. So some will store the least significant byte first, and some will store the most significant byte first. So when I say that, what I mean is this. So if we have the hex number 0xAABBCCDD, this is a 4-byte number, right? And this is sort of the 16 to the zeros place, right? And this is the 16 to the whatever it is, 8 place. Yes? So 16 to the 7th place, right? It's just like ones, tens, hundreds in your decimal notation, right? So if we draw the boundaries on bytes, this is the least significant byte, and this is the most significant byte, right? Sort of like the highest place and the lowest place. So a big endian system would store this in memory like this. A little endian system would store this in memory as DDCCBBAA. And so if you're reading things from memory, this can actually screw with you a little bit. So here's an example, right? We just have some integer x, we have a pointer to the integer, we dereference the pointer and we store our integer there or whatever. You could even just store as an integer. Here's a picture of memory, right? So this is the 0th byte, the 1, the 2, and the 3 bytes. On a big endian system, it's stored sort of the intuitive way that we'd expect it to be stored, right? On a little endian system, it's stored in reverse. And so x86, which is what we run on cloud.cs50 and what probably every single computer you use runs on, unless, you know, your computer was made 20 years ago, which one do we have? Anybody know? Somebody say it louder. So x86 is little endian, actually. So problem set 5 revisited. So if you recall, you had to sort of check for the start of a JPEG file, right? So you would read, call fread to read a block into memory, and then you'd inspect the beginning of that block to see if it had FFD8 FFE0, which is sort of like the tag that says, hey, this is the magic number that means the beginning of the JPEG. And most of you probably wrote code like on the top, like you're inspecting the values of memory, right? The 0, the 1, the 2, and the 3. That's a picture of memory. You could also write your code like this on the bottom. All right. So why did I reverse the order of the bytes here? Somebody tell me what I was doing.
So that it would work on a big endian system?
So work on a little endian system, because we're running on little endian, right? So I'm saying, here's buff. It's a pointer to some stuff. I'm casting it to an int star. So when I dereference it, I get 4 bytes at a time. But since this is a little endian system, when it dereferences, it's going to flip the order of the bytes that it gives me. So even though the bytes are in this order in memory, I've got to do the comparison in reverse order. All right, so memory leaks. And yes, Firefox is notorious for leaking a lot of memory. But what is a memory leak? So anytime you malloc something in your program, this call to malloc should always be accompanied by a corresponding call to free when you're done using the memory. So the reason why is because memory is not an infinite resource, right? We only have a limited amount of it. So every time we use some, we want to hold on to it for exactly how long we need, and then we want to give it back. And so this is not so much an issue with your programs, because as soon as you're done with the memory, you're pretty much exiting anyway. But if you'd imagine a program that has to run for several days at a time, or like your web browser, you open 400 tabs and then you close them and then you open another 400, imagine how much memory each tab is mallocing. If you don't give back all of that memory, you can pretty quickly run out of memory. And so this is actually a harder and harder task the bigger your application gets. So what's a tool you can use to check for memory leaks? Valgrind, right? And hopefully you all use this on problem set 6. So questions about any of this? All right. Next up we have Derek.
So now we're going to start talking about the internet, which will
be a big portion of the quiz. So first, I'm going to review some of the protocols that define the internet. So when you think of the internet, probably before you took CS50, you maybe thought of like Internet Explorer, and that's the internet, or something akin to that. Probably the best definition of the internet is a set of rules that defines how different computers communicate with each other. So some of the most important of those rules are TCP/IP. So when you hear TCP/IP, think, okay, that's what defines the internet, roughly. So IP, what IP does is it tells you how, on a higher level, two different computers are going to interact with each other. So the first thing to note is that every computer on the internet has a unique IP address. And that way, you can specify which other computer you want to send your data to. Also, the way that you send data is by breaking it up into tiny little chunks called packets. So this is this and the next bit aren't so important for the quiz, but you should know it. So if you want to send a movie or something, it would be pretty inefficient to form a connection between computer A and computer B if they're not connected by wire, and send the entire movie at once. In particular, if someone else wanted to send their data along that same line, they would have to wait until your movie was sent all the way through. So what you do is you break it up into small chunks, and you send these packets. Note that these packets can go in different directions. So if I wanted to send from this computer to that computer, it's not necessarily true that all the bits of information that I'm sending would follow the same route. So that's IP. TCP is Transmission Control Protocol, and it defines how different applications on your computer will interact with an application on another computer. So, for example, if you wanted to contact Firefox or send like some application-specific message, then you would need to know more than just which computer you're going to send the data to. So to do that, you assign a port number, which is just an integer, to every application on every computer. So that means that every program, or most applications, will have, you can access them by having your IP address and the port number, and that will uniquely specify that application on the internet. And TCP just assumes that IP exists to do its work. It could be that computers could talk to each other in different ways than IP, and TCP would still work. So a lot of times the rules that specify things in computer science will work independently of each other. So they'll just assume that some other set of rules is working. So do people have questions about that?
What does IP stand for?
Internet Protocol. Okay. So that's not all that important on the quiz. There's also HTTP, which is Hypertext Transfer Protocol. And this is something that you actually used, so it's a bit more important. So this is the set of rules that governs how a computer asks for some data from another computer. So it's not just the connection between them, it's actually in what way should I format my request to get data? If I'm a computer, how do I get data from computer B? Will these be online, Jesse, the slides?
Yes.
Okay, so don't just type everything on the slide, because it's online. Yes. Yeah. So the question is, what is a resource? And in computer science, there's a few sort of related definitions, but it's just kind of a general term that usually means something that I'm going to ask for and get back. Yes. So the question was, is HTTP similar to TCP/IP in that it defines how things interact? So yes, all HTTP and those other two things are is a list of rules that you could write down on a piece of notebook paper. To actually use those rules, you have to have everybody on your network agree that those are good rules and follow them. So this doesn't often happen in real life. It would be nice if it did. With these sets of protocols, these are very standard protocols. But for other networking problems, it's sometimes a very big problem that everybody decides on different ways of doing things. So the way that you guys have interacted with HTTP is primarily through GET and POST. These are the two ways that you know of requesting resources. So for our purposes, a resource is pretty much anything that you can ask for. You are getting XHTML, some PHP, and you can get other things too. So to send that GET request, if you looked at live HTTP headers maybe, then you would see things similar to that. To send that, you could use that form. So that's why that's right after that. And what you get back is the text of the request along with some information about how the request went. So you get a status code. And if it's 200, then that means, OK, I successfully got back the data I was asking for. There's a bunch of other codes, but you don't have to memorize the codes. The point is just as long as everybody agrees that that's what 200 means, then computers can actually communicate with each other. And again, HTTP assumes that something like TCP/IP exists. Otherwise, it couldn't do anything. Yes?
If you have a page like index.html that has 10 image tags, does that mean that you're going to be making 11 GET requests?
So the question was, is it a separate GET request if you have, if you're requesting index.html along with 10 GIFs or something? I'm pretty sure it is. I'm not 100% sure. So I would look that up. But I'm pretty sure that you have to. If they're in different places, you have to get them separately. If they're all in the same file, then maybe you don't. That's why I'm not sure. Any other questions? Okay, so HTTP parameters, those were the things that you were passing with GET and POST. One thing that you might want to do when you're asking for a web page is give it some sort of variable so that it can respond to you dynamically, so that it could give you a different result based on what you pass in. So to do that, that's roughly where HTTP comes in for this class. For GET, you pass the information through the URL. So the URL stands for Uniform Resource Locator, which is nice because, as I said earlier, there's all these different resources, right? But we have just one way of getting them through this Uniform Resource Locator, which is very helpful. So can someone tell me what's an advantage of GET over POST, and what's an advantage of POST over GET? This is where it would have been helpful if I had the bullets come up individually. So yeah.
Yeah,
so POST, we know that
post is has the advantage of not showing passwords and such things in the URL. But we haven't really talked about so much the advantage of using get over post. So the biggest advantage is that if you do a get, then that information still exists after the get. So you can say, fill in half of a form, and then if you maybe typed your password in wrong and then click submit, when you go back to that form, then you could have the answers that you typed still be there just by getting them again from the URL. So that's basically why you would ever want to use get over post. Jesse? Jesse hacked my slides, apparently. Yeah, that's true. I did not close my tags. That's very bad style. Okay, so next we'll talk about XHTML, but first, did anyone have questions about HTTP parameters? Okay. So the question is, where does it go when you do a get or a post? What actually sort of happens, right? So I'll get to that. But that's the roughly defined by the way that this is going to interact with your PHP. So that's a PHP-specific thing for your guys' purposes. Okay, so XHTML. This is the static content of a web page. And it's hypertext, which means it's like text, but awesome. So it can do more things than regular text could do. It can, you know, be different colors, but more specifically for the web, it can do things. If you click on it, something can happen. It can send some message. You can submit a form, that sort of thing. That's what makes it hyper. It's HTML just means those tags that make up the web page. The X stands for HTML that's well written. So again, there is a standard for how you should write your web pages, and that's called XML. And some people don't, and that's a lot of times okay, because then other people will write their web browsers in such a way that they'll understand badly written HTML, right? Something that doesn't conform to this worldwide standard. But you know, it adds a lot of extra work for the people who are writing the browsers, and it's also just kind of annoying to have people writing web pages in a ton of different ways. So it would be nice if everybody would follow one standard. So that's sort of why we've been telling you guys to do that. And RSS also conforms to XML. A bunch of other things do too. Okay. And just to stress again, if you didn't have these standards that everybody followed, it would be very hard to get networking to actually work. So does anyone have questions about that? Okay. So now we'll get to PHP. So PHP is a lot like C, but there's a few key things that made it a lot better than C for some of your guys' purposes. So the first one is that it can be inserted into XHTML. You can have your static web page, but then insert some PHP code in there and get dynamism. You can get a web page that changes, which is very valuable. Another thing that is very useful about PHP is just that there's so much functionality built into the language. So you know how David did Speller in like 8 minutes, right? That's basically because PHP already has a huge number of different things that it can do that you can just use. So you could do that in C, there exists a bunch of bodies of code online that you can download, some code libraries that you can use that other people wrote. And if you found something that did a try for you or did a hash table for you, then you too could have implemented Speller in 8 minutes or something. But in PHP, that's all just a natural part of the language. So that's the difference. So PHP is a scripting language. What does that mean? It means that it tells some software what to do. It directs some application. So that's why it's scripting, because it's directing something. So for example, you can tell Firefox to do something. You can tell your email program to send an email. More importantly, for our course, you can interact with SQL. You can tell MySQL what to do. So JavaScript is also a scripting language, the script. When you're studying for the quiz, make sure you don't get those confused. So the biggest difference between PHP and JavaScript is that PHP is interpreted on the server, and JavaScript is interpreted on the client. So what does that mean? So first, neither of the languages are compiled, like C. So if you have, there's nothing like GCC for PHP or JavaScript. All you have to do is write the code, and then another program called an interpreter will read in your code and interact with it, and there's no separate step where you have to compile. And there's good things and bad things about that. So the difference between server and client, though. If you have two computers that are communicating, say you have computer A, and this is computer A, and I'm going to send a message to computer B. So what will happen in the web environment, I guess, is that computer B will ask for some information from computer A. And then computer A will respond to computer B. And before it responds, it'll interpret all of the PHP. That's the big difference. It'll do all the PHP, and then it'll pass back all of the XHTML and the JavaScript. And then the JavaScript is run on the client computer. So that's a very important distinction. Does anyone have questions about that?
So JavaScript is kind of like a part of the XHTML and the PHP that's sent back. And then once it reaches the computer, it's then interpreted.
OK, so the question was, is JavaScript kind of like the HTML in that it gets sent from the server to the client before you use it? The answer is yes. So the client computer gets all the JavaScript and it gets all of the HTML and uses those things to construct a web page with a browser. So that's useful for one big reason for the purposes of CS50. In that you can run your JavaScript without making another request to the server. So it can be a lot faster to do something in JavaScript. Okay, so what are get and session, actually? So those things are associative arrays in PHP. So what that means is, say I'm going to hand a URL to a computer, and I'm going to request, I'm going to say get index.html. That computer, or say it's index.php, because this is PHP, then that computer can use this get array to figure out what was it that they actually wanted me to get. And the same thing happens with a post. The session is a little different, though. So the session actually stores a little text file called a cookie on the client computer. So the one that made the request will you'll send a request, and then they'll say, okay, but I need to check that you're logged in correctly. So then if you didn't send the cookie along with your request, then they will force you to go back and re-log in. So that's roughly how that works. Any questions about that? Okay. And lastly, SQL. So SQL is a structured query language. Its purpose is for interacting with databases. So select, update, and such are queries. And I'll just do some examples with you guys. So select star. Star means anything. So it's a common thing to do in computer science. If you do like rm star dot c, then it will remove everything that starts with a star and ends with a dot c from your directory. So in that case, the star just means it's a variable that can stand for anything. So this one will look up all of the rows in your zips which have population greater than 50, and then it returns a reference to that information. And then to actually use that information, you need to turn it into something that PHP can understand. So if you do MySQL fetch object on the return from select, it'll turn it into an object. And then you can do whatever that object is, arrow, and then access the fields. If you do MySQL fetch array on the result, then it'll take it and turn it into array so that you can use it just like you would normally use a PHP array. So what's this second one? Why is this special? So there's two tables here. If I just did the first part, just the select star from table one, table two, what that'll do is return all the rows from table one with the information from table two adjoined onto each of the rows. So in other words, if table one is of size 5 rows and table two is of size 6 rows, I'm going to get back 30 rows. So that's oftentimes not what you want, but oftentimes you do want to access information that is stored in two different separate SQL tables. So to do that, you need to make sure you use your wheres correctly. So you can say, get the information where the name in the first table is the same as the name in the second table. So do people have questions about that? Okay. So in PHP, the question is, what's the difference between fetching an object versus fetching an array? So in PHP, you just treat objects and arrays differently. You guys probably did MySQL fetch array, right? You could have done the pset doing MySQL fetch object. It would have been just fine. And then you would have just used the object notation to access things. You could have done that. So for your purposes, not so much of a difference. Yeah?
In SQL, is something equal to something else just one equal sign?
In where's, yes. I'm pretty sure. In SQL, do you just use one equal sign for logic? And I'm pretty sure you do. Okay. And the last bit of SQL. So there's two different ways to insert. You can look at each of the columns and say what they equal. Alternatively, you can write out all the different columns and then assign them values. Those two things are equivalent. So don't get tripped up if we throw both of them at you on the quiz. Also, you need to be careful that you always call MySQL real escape string on everything that a user inputs. So if the user inputs something like delete your whole table and you try to run that, then maybe the user was smart enough to get the statement in the correct formatting that it will actually delete your table. So MySQL real escape string will prevent people from doing that. And the last little trick is, so every line of code that you do in PHP, since it's an interpretive language, it will run that line of code and then move on to the next one. So you can abuse this fact if they are writing PHP that is interacting with a SQL table. So say they have a SQL table and they're going to buy some shares of stock. So what you could do is if they wrote the code that gives them the shares of stock before they wrote the code that says take away their money, then if you're really fast, you can have the code, or more clever, you can have the code that says give them the stock run and then like turn off your computer or something to that effect. And it'll actually just give them the stock and then not run the code that takes away their money. So you have to be very careful if you are using SQL and you're like Bank of America or something, because you can imagine that people would try very hard to rip off Bank of America. Okay, so that's that. Does anyone have any questions? Okay. So, Nazmat.
Okay. So the topics I'm going to be covering are going to be related mostly to things which you should be relatively familiar with, since they're things we've been covering in the last couple weeks. You've used them a lot in your P sets. I'm going to attempt to try to kind of flesh out some of the underlying concepts a bit just to give a better understanding. I'm going to be covering JavaScript, cascading style sheets, the DOM. Don't worry if you haven't heard that term before. I'll cover what exactly I mean, and you'll see that you have been using it the entire time, as well as how to do AJAX calls. And a slideshow. Are you kidding me? Oh, okay. Mine's in a separate slideshow. Okay. I apologize for the aesthetic inconsistency here. There was a small miscommunication, but by way of apology, please enjoy this visual pun. So you see here we have quite literally cascading style sheets. I thought it was cute. Some of you might as well. All right, moving on. So you may not have used anything you might refer to as generally as a style sheet, like a separate document which contains stylistic information on the previous P sets. You didn't really have to worry too much about making the pages look nice. We kind of took it upon ourselves to give you nicely formatted pages to begin with, made that a little easier for you. But what cascading style sheets allow for is the easy formatting of XHTML documents in order to make certain regions of your page formatted a certain way, so you don't have to explicitly say for each tag within your XHTML document, I want this tag formatted this specific way. You can kind of generalize it within a separate style sheet or up at the top of your XHTML document, and I'll show you exactly how that is implemented. As I've mentioned on the slide here, it may be included in a separate file or it can be inlined right into your XHTML code in the same document. Okay, so this is essentially how you would format this CSS type. So you would first write the name of a selector, which is basically the name of a tag. If you imagine that said body, this would essentially be making a set of declarations which tell us how we want to format everything that is found in the body tag. Another thing we can do, which is kind of handy, is include the name of a field, which is preceded by this period. And what the field allows you to do is... treat this as the name of a class. And what this allows is a little bit of a modularity where you can set an attribute called class in any tag on your page, set that equal to the name of the field which we declared here, and then include that particular formatting information in that division of your page without having to specify each different division at the name of the tag that you are going to be placing this formatting information within. So it just allows you kind of to generalize and import, if you will, a certain class of stylistic information into a specific region in your page. Now, I'd say declarations. What exactly does a CSS declaration look like? Maybe you haven't heard it described in that particular way. We'll take a look at these. So we have font size, colon small. So it seems like we're taking some attribute of our style, following it by a colon, and then setting it equal to something. In this case, we're making the font size small, and then ending that with a semicolon. Some of you may have used things like this in your presets. Some of you may not have, but there's one that I'm sure many of you have used. Display block in some of your AJAX calls on PSA 8. You might also remember you can set that to display none. So what this is, the reason I include this is to kind of bring attention to how different things you're doing are connected through this CSS formatting. When you make use of the document object model, which I'll cover in just a moment, to change different elements on your page, if you recall, you were editing the values of different attributes of different elements on your page. You recall that you were able to modify the style by accessing dot style and then dot, in this case, display. What you were doing is reaching essentially into the CSS formatting of that element, getting this attribute, and then modifying its value. So you can see how all these things are essentially linked, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to make sure we really took a look at what was going on here. So how would you include CSS in the form of this style sheet type arrangement? In a next HTML file, you can include it right in the script tag, in a script tag in the head of your XHTML file. So you would just write style type equals text CSS, much like if you were including JavaScript, you'd write text/JavaScript, just to let the browser know what's coming and how to interpret it. Media equals all. And then you'd place your declarations right within here. So you can see how you can just place all that CSS formatting information right in, inlining it right into your XHTML file. No need for a separate file at all. If you wanted to include more of this information and not clutter up your XHTML file, then it might be a good idea to include it in a separate file which can be linked into your XHTML file. The method by which you would do that is by including a link tag in the head. And you'll see here that we're much like in our hyperlink tags, we're including this href attribute to this link tag, sending it equal to styles.css, which is presumably a text file which lives in the same directory and contains the CSS formatting information. And once again, just setting, oh, this is new, rel equals style sheet, just to let it know that it is in fact a style sheet. The type is text CSS again, and media is once again all. Any questions? Yeah, any questions about this? Go ahead.
What does media refer to?
Media?
It's prints or screen. It's the format that the document's going to be viewed in.
Yeah. Yeah, good. Oh, they were asking What is the meaning of the media attribute, and it relates to in what form the document is going to be viewed and how we're going to be formatting it. It's not especially important to the overall meaning of what's going on here, but yeah, that's essentially what the attribute is doing.
So is the rel attribute actually mandatory? Or if you left it off, would the browser still retrieve the
same? It may vary based on the browser. I'm not entirely sure if most browsers would tend to support it without that, but I think that it's of course better form to include that attribute. Okay, now this is perhaps a little bit intimidating looking, so please don't concern yourself with this entire picture at large. You, of course, are not responsible for most of this. I understand that David has not been referring to this as the document object model very often within lecture. We focus mainly on how we put this into practice. But this image just basically shows how when your browser is looking at a web page, it basically treats the entire web page it's looking at as sort of like having a directory structure where there are different aspects of the page which is keeping track of. And by isolating each specific thing, like go to the document first and then perhaps go to something else which is contained within the document, you can get to different parts of the web page as it's displayed in the browser. And I'll show a couple examples just to refresh you on exactly how to do that, to do that, although it should be quite fresh in your mind considering you just completed PISA 8 so recently. So the document object model is just a term used to describe what exactly we're doing when we write things like document.getElementsById and then change their attributes. It's used to reference elements of the web page in order to get their values and to change them dynamically. It works very closely with JavaScript to allow you to change your page after it's been passed to the client side, to the browser. All elements on a web page are accessible through the DOM. You can get to pretty much absolutely anything on the web page using the document object model. And it can change any attribute of any of these elements, including a very useful one called innerHTML, which, as it sounds, allows you to manipulate the HTML which is contained within an element. So perhaps if you had a div tag on a page and then you had some HTML code contained within, all the HTML code is set to the attribute innerHTML, and that can be modified on the fly, allowing you to fundamentally change everything on your web page through the document object model. Any questions about what this means? Okay. So much like you've been doing in your past PSETs, you were able to make use of the document object model to get values from your page in this manner. For example, if I have a text box on the page, maybe it contains the value high. Then if I were to run or to write out document.getElementById, refer to the text box element on the page, and then get the value attribute, text box value will have the value high. I've successfully pulled out a piece of information stored in an attribute of an element on the web page, and I've stored it in a variable here. Presumably, I'd be doing this in JavaScript. I can also make use of this to change elements. I don't have to just reach in and grab things. I can dynamically insert, in this example, a text string into a text box without having to have the user type it in. I can do that through the document object model just using some JavaScript. So in this case, if I've declared a text box that has the value high, and then I use this line here, document.getElementById, textbox.value, and I use an assignment and set it to the string dom dom dom, the text box will now have the value dom dom dom. So you can see how, once again, JavaScript allows us to dynamically change things as well as get information out of the page. Okay, so now we're going to move on to JavaScript. This is a book I just found when I was doing a little, just catching up on some of the finer points of JavaScript just to prepare for sections as well as just to review, figure out what the points are I should cover during this review section. So we're, of course, going to cover the good parts about JavaScript, but since we're being realistic, we also have to cover the bad parts and the annoying parts. So let's get to that. So properties of language. Derek provided a pretty good segue into this in his discussion on the differences and similarities between PHP and JavaScript. JavaScript is an interpreted language. That means it's unlike C in that C would generally, it's a compiled language. So you write out your code, you compile it, much like Jesse described to you at length. It becomes this executable file, which is then run, resulting in your code being executed in the computer doing whatever you told it to in your original source code. We skip a step in interpreted languages. You write out your source code, the interpreter runs through it, and right on the fly, it executes the statements. It takes your code and translates it into action just directly through the interpreter without creating this separate executable file. We have client-side execution in JavaScript. This distinguishes it from PHP, which is another interpreted language which we tend to use in web design, particularly in this course. Whereas PHP executes on the server, which means it's executing on a different machine. The code is never sent to the user who is getting the resultant web page. JavaScript is actually passed as part of the XHTML file to the user, and it's never executed until it gets to the user's browser. The interpreter for JavaScript actually is a part of the web browser, which is being used by the user, presumably, and is executing on your machine when you view the web page in order to make whatever the JavaScript is designed to do happen on your screen. It's also a loosely typed language. There's a distinction between a loosely typed and a strongly typed language. A strongly typed language is, again, like C, an example of a language where you, when you declare variables, for example, if I were to write something like, if I wanted to declare an integer, x, in C I'd have to write something like int x. I have to declare what the data type is, and whenever I assign something to x, I have to make sure that I'm adhering to that data type or else I'm going to get an error. So if I tried to write something like x equals 5.2, 5.2 is a floating point value. That's not an integer. I'm going to get an error. I'm not allowed to do that. By contrast, in JavaScript, which is a loosely typed language, I can define a variable. I don't need to worry about what its type is. I can just write var x. I have this local variable x. I don't have to worry about what the type is. I can put whatever I want in there. After I've put something in there, presumably maybe I put a number in there. I set it to x equals 5.2. I make it a floating point number. If I want, I can go back later and change it to x equals, like, I don't know, a string. It could be a parakeet. It could be whatever you imagine. You can do absolutely anything with that variable. You can change it to any type that you want. It doesn't matter. JavaScript will take care of it under the hood. It's not something you have to concern yourselves with. And that's what it means to be loosely typed. Okay, so I covered this already in my discussion of it being a loosely typed language, but if you want to declare a local variable in JavaScript, you just write var x followed by that semicolon. This declares a local x, and the type need not be specified by virtue of this being a loosely typed language. X may contain any type of value, and you can actually change the type, which is stored there on the fly. If you want to declare an array, in C you would normally have to declare the size of the array when you declare the array so it knows to allot the appropriate amount of memory. Not so in JavaScript. X equals left square bracket, right square bracket, semicolon. That declares an empty array. You can put whatever you want in it. You can put things of mixed type. You can put any number of elements in it without having to worry about exceeding the amount of memory which is allotted to you. JavaScript will dynamically get you more memory if it needs to. It's not something you need to concern yourselves with. And once again, to emphasize this, you can store different types of values within the same array. It doesn't matter. I can have an integer, a Boolean value, a null value, a string, a floating point. It doesn't matter. You could have a function in there as well if you wanted. Functions are a valid data type in JavaScript. And if you overreach the bounds of your array, say here I have 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. This would be the number 4 element. If I reached for number 5, x5, in C, you'd get a seg fault, which is decidedly inconvenient in some circumstances, and in other ways very convenient because it lets you know that you are, in fact, trying to reach beyond your array, and perhaps you should reevaluate your algorithm. But in this case, it just returns the value undefined. It doesn't give us a seg fault. The JavaScript doesn't fail. It just returns the value undefined, telling us, okay, there's nothing here. You haven't declared something in your array. I can't give you any particular value, so I'm giving you back undefined. Types in JavaScript. So I mentioned that function is a type. The other types would be a number, a string, a Boolean, an object, like I said, function, null, or undefined, which is what's returned when you're unable to get something out of an array because you're overreaching that which you have already declared. A useful piece of syntax in JavaScript, if for some reason you need to get the current type of a value stored in a variable, since you can't always depend on a certain type of a value being stored in a variable, as this is a loosely typed language, as I've previously mentioned several times, you can use type of x, and it will return the type of x, whatever value is stored within that variable. So if I declared x and I gave it the value 5, I would get back number when I evaluated type of x. Any questions about anything so far? Yeah. She asked if x were an array, what type would be returned? That's a good question, and I'm not entirely sure of the answer. I don't want to give you a specific answer to that because I'm not entirely sure. I know that if you referred to a specific element within the array, that you would get the type of that value, but I don't want to give you a committed answer to that because I'm not exactly sure. It's possible that it might be an object because it's kind of sort of a structure containing each of these values. But that's something you can easily look up, just JavaScript documentation online. But that's a good question. I'm not entirely sure. Yes?
Can you store arrays in arrays?
She asked if you can store arrays in an array.
Yeah, so like you can have an array. Like,
I believe you can do that.
Would that be considered a type then? Like, is an array type? It's not like.
When I looked up JavaScript types to refresh myself on this, I was given these. These are all the types which are available in JavaScript. Array itself is not a type, which is why I'm uncertain as to what the type would be. I think it might be an object, but I'm not. You think it's an object? Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I mean, of course it could return undefined because it's not a valid type. But I'd be willing to bet that it's object. But again, I don't want to say with any degree of certainty. But yes, you can place arrays with an array. I think so. Yeah. But yes, you should be able to place an array within an array. So you have nested arrays. Okay. Event handlers. These are something that you've been using extensively within Ajax. if you think back to your Scratch problem set back at the beginning of the semester, you remember you were broadcasting these messages, I think we called them, and receiving these messages and doing something as a result. So essentially what you were doing is saying, okay, I'm setting up this event handler. When I receive this message, which is really an event, I think they did refer to them as events in Scratch. So when I receive this event, I want to do this, execute all these puzzle pieces, which, thinking about it now, it was essentially a function. So in JavaScript, you're able to set up something similar, referred to explicitly now as an event handler. And what happens is that you set up this event handler, once again, which looks out for an event and is assigned to a function, a series of statements, some code, that you want to execute whenever that event happens. This allows you to accommodate responses to anything that might happen in your code which you would want to respond to without having to perhaps naively iterate through a loop which checks each time whether this condition is true and then take an action. It just happens immediately as soon as this event occurs. So you can imagine how that'd be very useful in a lot of contexts. So events in the context of web design can be included right in XHTML tags. For example, if I wanted something to happen when I clicked on a division of my page, I can include an onClick attribute, which is an event handler. Most things that start with on and then some kind of verb are going to tend to be event handlers, particularly when we're talking about JavaScript and XHTML. OnLoad, when the page loads, do something. OnSubmit, when I submit a form, do something. And this leads us into our discussion on AJAX, which is a key player in the Web 2.0 revolution of a few years back. AJAX stands for Asynchronous JavaScript and XML, and allows your web pages to reach out to a web page on a different server or even in the same server, but do this asynchronously, meaning that it doesn't actually have to navigate to that page and switch focus of the browser to this new web page. It can just kind of do it in the background. What's essentially happening is you're reaching out, you're sending an HTTP request, much like you would when you navigate to a web page to get back whatever the page's contents are, but you're doing it behind the scenes such that you're able to get this response back from the web page and do something with it without ever having to leave the page you're already on. So this you can easily see, and I'm sure you have, based on what you've been doing with PSET 8, how this allows you to create these really nice effects and facilitate these dynamic websites, which are very useful. If you look at any even like relatively simple-looking page, like the Google homepage, you can see how AJAX has just become something that's really extensively used in a lot of modern web pages. When you start typing in a search term, you'll notice that you get a bunch of suggestions as to what you might want to complete your string as, what you might be looking for just based on a few characters you typed. What's happening there is it's sending out a request to Google, getting that information, and pulling it back behind the scenes using something like an AJAX call, something asynchronous, which allows the web page to do things behind the scenes without shifting focus, without requiring you to move to another web page, just staying on the same page and generating this dynamic content. So, how do we make an AJAX call? The first thing we need to do is generate the request object. So we would create an XML HTTP request if we're using some modern browser, presumably. If we're using an older Microsoft browser, some older version of Internet Explorer, we'd use an ActiveX object. And for those less compatible, maybe if you're using a text-based browser or something like Lynx, which doesn't support any type of AJAX calls, then we'd want to return an error message just to let them know that they're missing out. So how do we construct this XHR object? After we've declared it, we've made this XML HTTP request or something similar. We've, for the sake of our discussion, we'll say we just called it XHR for convenience's sake. You could have called it request, and you may have done that for PSET 8. We then construct a URL, just a string, to which we want to send this request, whatever web page it is we want to get a response from. We set up an event handler, that on ready state change event handler. So we're checking to see when the ready state, and I'll describe what that means exactly in a moment, of our request changes so that we can check if the request is finished loading and do something as a result. We then open up the request. We declare the method which we're using. Get has been what we've been using for PSET 8 and other purposes. We also include the URL and you may have noticed there was a Boolean true argument which was passed. This is just affirming that we're making an asynchronous call, if anyone was curious as to why we're including that true value. and then we just send the request. We actually send out this XML HTTP request. It goes to the server, and the server responds by sending back the response text or response XML, or in the case of the PISA 8 response deck, which contains information formatted in such a way that we can pull data out of it. And just to go back and, to discuss the ready state change and how we're using an event handler to check that, the ready state is essentially an attribute of our request, which tells us the state, well, obviously the state of the request, whether or not it's completed. It varies from 1 to 4. All you really need to know is that 4 means that the request has been loaded, it's completed, and we can now proceed and do something else with it. The next thing we do is check if the status is equal to 200. I believe Derek covered this on his slides as well. If you get a status of 404, I'm sure you're all familiar with that particular number as it relates to the internet. It means file not found. There wasn't whatever file you're trying to send a request to, we couldn't get to. 403, forbidden, unable to get there because the permissions were set up in such a way that we weren't allowed to touch it. 200, you don't ever see in your web browser because it means things worked and you don't need to see an error message. So we want to make sure that it's equal to 200 before we try to do anything with the response. And then what we do then is we make use of the response text as we did in problem set 8, or if we wanted the response XML, perhaps in another context. Don't worry too much about that because we haven't really covered getting XML as a reply. But you get the response text, do whatever you want with it in your function, which is responding to this ready state change. And that constitutes your AJAX call. So this is an example to refresh everyone on the how this is implemented in code in JavaScript. We would first set up our object, this var xhr. We then have a function in which we are instantiating this request and sending it out. First, we try to create a new XML HTTP request. If we can't do that, we make the ActiveX object. We try to handle old browsers if we were unable to create the object at all. Afterwards, we would construct our URL to send to. In this case, I'm just using ajaxhelper.php, which is presumably the page I'm sending this to and which will respond with the text that I want to get to. And then we send it out. We set onReadyStateChange, which is a property of the XHR object, to the function which we are going to be making use of. It's on the next slide. Open up the request, send the request out, and let's take a look at the handler function, which is going to handle whatever response we get from this AJAX call. Very simple construction. Check if the ready state is equal to 4. Check if the status is 200. If these two conditions are satisfied, then in this case, I'm just using a simple JavaScript reference to the document object model to get an element by its ID. We're calling it output, and then filling its inner HTML, which is an attribute which allows me to change the HTML within a division of the page, and placing the response text there, allowing me to dynamically reach out, get information from another page, and then place that on my page using JavaScript. So, yeah, that's essentially AJAX, and that concludes this review session. Are there any questions before we end? Okay. Thank you guys very much, and good luck on the quiz.